Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The idea of the building is that there's no internal corridors and there are no internal staircases. So right. Every space has a direct relationship to the yard. And the yard is sort of, you know, in a way, the common ground.
Then big enough to get some trucks in here,
yeah,
isn't it?
And, yeah, and these doors are 4 metres by 4 metres.
We've just... this is Adam. This is John.
Sir Anthony Gormley, Britain's most successful contemporary sculptor, creator of Angel of the North, invites me to his vast studio complex in King's Cross to talk about the artwork he made, the work he wishes he'd made, and the work he's making.
You've just launched a major exhibition at the Royal Academy, which is a lot of new work, but also artwork, which is familiar as well, and the themes that have been there at the centre of your work for now for several decades. It's the body, it's our place in space. Space is really important, isn't it, to you?
I think that's what sculpture does. Sculpture can activate space. But, you know, I think we always think of space as being the interval between things. But I think space also exists inside of us. And, you know, I'm always saying, when you close your eyes, where are you? Well, you are somewhere, but it's difficult to say where it is because it doesn't have any edges. It's kind of empty. But I think of that interior space, the space of the viewer, the space of the subject that moves through the spaces that might be activated by sculpture, as maybe the most important. That's the space of imagination. That is what you're trying to, in a way, make contact with. And so far as I'm concerned, the exhibition at the RA, yeah, the viewer is there is no other subject other than the viewer as he or she moves through these 13 rooms. And I guess that's, for me, the big joy and the big challenge of making sculpture today. It's no longer serving power. It's not telling stories about myths or religious revelation, or about trying to support the political status quo. We don't have a political status, let alone a status quo at the moment. Yeah, it's actually doing something else, which is saying, attend to this present moment and to these displaced materials, some of which have been formed, some of which haven't, and attend to your own reactions, primarily physical reactions. This is a collaboration. I think of the exhibition as in a way an invitation to co-produce something of value, which intrinsically is not in the work itself. These are all invitations to work with these emptinesses, with these masses, with these darknesses, with these lights, with these lines, with these surfaces, with these masses, with gravity, with space and time.
And a co-production between artist and viewer.
Yeah,
and visitor.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a lovely circularity to the exhibition. We arrive in the courtyard of the Royal Academy, and there you almost trip over it as you walk in. Small baby, almost like a newborn baby, curled up there on the floor, and it looks so vulnerable, and it draws you in, and it's cast. It's a cast baby sculpture. And then right at the end of the exhibition, after we pass through a series of rooms which are filled with quite monumental artworks, there is a gallery filled with seawater and mud, and it made me think we've come full circle, because it is from the mud, from the swamp, that we first emerged, and that baby springs to mind again.
Yeah, I guess the thing about time, generation, our place in an elemental world at a time where everything is information, everything is communicatable digitally. I mean, I think that's the broader context of this. And I want art to be about life, about, as it were, how human life connects with all life. You could say the elemental world has been brought into this temple of culture with its gilded ceilings and fine rooms. I've removed all signs of the 20th and 21st century, so there is no lighting in there whatsoever. We simply have this space lit with skylight, and you know, if you go after dark, if you go after sunset at 7:15, you will see it in the dark. But for me, this is an encounter with our origins, with, if you like, the primal soup, with in a sense the place that we all come from, but also this offering, I think, to say these are the elements on which we depend and on which the future life of the biosphere depends. And you stand there as a witness to it with an idea of what are you going to do with your consciousness, your freedom of action, your will, your power now, this extraordinary moment of our species being gifted with a technology of enormous potency. Are we going to continue to use it in a way to exploit those elemental truths of earthly existence, or are we going to find a way of working with it and finding human nature as part of nature, as an extension of nature? You know, we are listening to the voices of children, we're listening to the Greta Thunbergs of this world, because they're telling us in some senses where the Enlightenment project, how rationality and experimentation and therefore tooling has taken us, and just say you've got to get your priorities right. And I think there are things that art can do in terms of providing places in which the consequences of the kinds of truths that Greta is speaking can be turned into internal action. We have a crisis of our civilization. We have to recalibrate what being civilized means. And I believe that art can help us do that.
I'm going to ask you about three artworks. One that you made, one that you wish you'd made, one that you're making at the moment. Just before we do that, and you mentioned Greta Thunberg, who's still, 16 years old, who is looking to the future, helping other people decide what sort of future we're going to live in. Think back to 16, being 16, young Anthony Gormley at 16. What did you have an idea of what you would be doing in the future and what role you might play? Was there a sort of a sense that you might offer something to society in the same way?
I had no idea, age 16, and I think it's always a wonderful wake-up call when you meet people like that, when you meet, you know, a pianist age 8 who is able to play Bach partitas perfectly, and you realize that's the potential of human intelligence and sensibility. But I wasn't. That wasn't me.
When did art start then?
I think. Oh well, no, art was always there from the very beginning. I was always sort of writing poetry and making a mess. And I had my own studio. Probably from about the age of 8, I transformed the garden shed in Hampstead Garden Suburb into my laboratory, and I had my chemistry set, and I had my I would make potions and explosions and that kind of thing.
Did you see it as art then?
No. It was just that I needed to get out of the house and do my own thing in a space that I could make my own. And I guess nothing's changed.
I was going to say it's the same thing. Looking around me here in your studio, I mean, we have all the way around. There are big paintings, black monochrome paintings, which evoke the sense of that kind of curled aluminium that we see in one of the early galleries in the Royal Academy. I described it the other day when I was in there, like a giant slinky which has come unwound. You know, those things you used to roll down the stairs as a kid. Yeah. But there is a sense of play in here. You're still experimenting.
Play is the, you know, it is the beginning of everything. What happens when you put this next to this? Or what happens when you smash this next to this, into this, observing something arise that wasn't there before? I mean, that's the magic of art. So I think I've always done that. I remember I used to make these potions, which were mixtures of pigment and chemicals and whatever, and seal them and put them behind the books in my father's library, and then sort of with the view of unearthing them, years later. And I realized that the life in my garden shed was going to be my life,
and here you are,
and here I am.
So there are so many artworks. There must be, what we're talking about, 4 decades of work now. And you have returned to the subject of the body, of space, of place, time and time again. The work I made, so many people think instantly The Angel of the North with you. Is that the one of which you are proudest, or are you nominate
someone else? No, I wanted to talk about another place.
Another place,
the piece in Crosby Beach that was going to be temporary. It was going to be there for a year, but it's now been there for 10 years.
So that's just for those who don't know, there are 100 pieces, casts, Gormleys,
they're very simple.
It's sort of across 3 kilometre?
It's about 3.5 kilometres long and about 1 kilometre out to sea.
Crosby Beach near Liverpool.
This is Mersey Crosby Estuary. The north side of the Crosby Estuary. This amazing industrial beach, and you look out to North Wales, you look out to a great array of wind turbines that weren't there when I put the piece in. I was a bit worried about when they first came, isn't this going to be a distraction? But in fact, it's just a reinforcement in a way of this, I think, question that the work asks: what is our relationship in a way, nature, with what lies the other side of the horizon.
Those figures are gazing out to the horizon. Almost they look as if they are starting a journey. They're kind of sort of wading their way across the ocean there.
Yeah, they're on a single plane, which means that they get completely covered by the sea. There's quite a massive tide variation of over 10 metres. So the pieces that are a kilometre out, at high tide, they're 30 foot below the surface of the sea. Yeah, the work is very simple. It's 17 life casts of me made by my wife, Vicken Parsons, another wonderful artist with whom I'm still very much in love and with whom I could not have really proceeded in my project. But anyway, these 17 moments are just moments of breathing in and breathing out, some of them subtly more tense than others. Some have a fully inflated chest. Some of them are completely with the breath fully out of the body. They are all looking west, looking towards America. And now the ones that are most exposed to the greatest range of both sea, being covered by the sea and being dried by the wind, are their surfaces are spalling. They've lost up to 6 millimeters of surface, and they're actually disintegrating, but in the most beautiful way.
Does that bother you?
Not at all. No, the ones that are
furthest out are covered in barnacles and therefore are sort of protected by this organic paint that is alive. The ones that are high up the beach are as they were when they were first put in. It's only the ones that are in this median tide plain that are really, really moving with time and the effect of the elements. And I think this is very much, you know, it's called Another Place, but it is a meditation on our relationship, with, as it were, the sea that divides us but also connects us. The extraordinary thing about sculpture is that it doesn't need a building. It doesn't need protection. It doesn't need a label. It doesn't need curation. It can simply be in the world. It can be on the street. It can be on a beach. It can be on top of a mountain and just be there night and day, snow, showers, sunshine. And it becomes not just a marker in space and performing the alchemy of changing a site into a place where some degree of habitation has happened, some degree of human connection has happened. And I think that is what sculpture can do. So it's a marker in space, but then also a marker in time. So here are these, I do think of them as industrial fossils. They are a moment of human lived time that has been taken out of time. But now it's placed in a context of sidereal time, of the time of the tides, of lunar time. And it's there for everyone. So it's not enclosed within an institution. You don't have to pay a ticket to go. It's there, all the time, and it's open for everyone. And people go and walk their dogs, and their dogs pee on the sculptures, and they put their brassieres and their swimming hats and their condoms and their club ties on the work. I suppose there's an openness to that work and a resilience. The continual story of human migration, the idea that over that horizon there's another place where life may be better, life may be possible at all.
There's a new resonance to that piece because of the images that we've seen of people crossing oceans and being wading through water, struggling with the tides.
In a time of mass migration now, that thought is so much in all of our minds. And there's a time when people are dying crossing the English Channel to get here.
Difficult question when I ask any artist about the work you wish you'd made, because of course you didn't make it and you can't really wish to have made somebody else's work because you are not that person. Any work of art is very personal. Which work of art do you admire? That's, you know, a work that has had a major influence on you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I just have to go back to 1979, arriving really for the first time in New York and just feeling that incredible energy and wanting to make contact with artists and works that I had always admired and, you know, now had the opportunity. I had this traveling scholarship to meet. And I went to see Mark Lancaster, who was a friend who had been in the artist residence at King's in Cambridge. And he said, oh, well, why don't you go down? There's a new work by Walter de Maria in New Mexico. Why don't you go down and see it? It had been in existence for about 18 months by then, but Walter de Maria was there himself with John, his photographer, who is the author of those extraordinary photographs where you see the lightning field in the foreground and lightning strikes, but actually nowhere near. They're about like 25 miles south of the field itself.
Just explain what the lightning field is.
The lightning field is this. If we still think that sculpture is a singular object, often a naked lady made out of marble, this is the complete opposite. This is a field. It's a field effect. It is space, not thing-based. And it's 1 mile long by a kilometre wide. It's about 200-odd spikes that are about 20 foot high each.
Steel.
They're stainless steel, very, very, very highly polished with these very, very literally needle sharp points that describe an absolutely horizontal plane. It's 7,200 feet above mean sea level on this high plateau covered in desert bush.
And how very, tall they're each very, needle is?
Each needle is 20 foot.
20 foot,
That's the mean height. The mean height is, but actually, the topography of the land changes quite a bit.
So each needle is a different height.
Needle is a different height. So,
but yeah. From a distance, they look like they are at the same.
Yeah, if you look from a distance, you're aware of this plane that is described by the needle points. And the drama of arrival at Quemado and then going in four-wheel drive for an hour or two up into the mountains and then arriving at this extraordinary clear-skied open space surrounded by mountains, and you put your stuff in a log cabin which is at one side of the field. You're given a water bottle, and out you go. And it's just you and the silence and the heat and the light. And the ground is stony. You are aware, almost painfully aware, of the crunching of your feet as they like make contact with the sand and the stone. It's a harsh landscape, but these needles literally are an acupuncture of space, and you feel through their agency that you are more alive and alert and present than you would be without them. And then the magic starts as the light begins to fade. So these needles pick up this change in the colour of the sky.
They start to glow
this amazing gold that gets deeper and deeper until they are these gilded red rods that are plugged into the firmament. And it's an extraordinary thing. It is a work that deals with light, space and time in a way that totally transformed my idea about what art could be. That you bring these highly manufactured objects into this untouched landscape
And suddenly the present experience of anyone moving through that is transformed. I think that's the best art can do, to return you to the miracle of being alive. Yeah, it was a...
How long were you there for?
Deep inspiration. I think we were there for about 4 days.
4 days, and you stay in the log cabin.
Stayed in the log cabin.
You do nothing but just sort of contemplate the landscape.
It was also the time of the full moon, so we were out there, day and night.
Walter de Maria was there with you.
And Walter de Maria was there with me, with Jack Daniels, which is his favourite bourbon. So we had a very nice time.
He's a really interesting guy, Walter de Maria. He started out as a drummer with the Velvet Underground, band that became the Velvet Underground. Yeah, he was in a band with Lou Reed. Yeah. They were called the Primitives, I think that was what they were called. I don't know what happened to his rock and roll career.
He still had a drum set in his... in his studio when I knew him in New York.
Really?
The really interesting is, he sort of started as a painter on the West Coast, and yet we think of him now as this highly cerebral, almost spiritual kind of hermit of New York. I think he retained the freedom of spirit of that Velvet Underground moment. I think he also, from his association with Lou Reed and I guess Cale as well, the idea that you could be, you just had to hoe your own row. You just had to stick with the things you believed in. And he was very kind to Vicken and I, and gave me a lot of encouragement.
I've got to say, he created one of the... an artwork which has stayed with me since I first saw it many years ago, 18 years ago in New York, and that's the Earth Room. Yeah. And it's in a street in Soho,
Green Street. No, maybe it's Mercer. Maybe
in what would have been a sort of warehouse building, you go onto the third floor, and it's there, and it's a room packed full of fresh, moist earth, which
it
you can
isn't
smell.
Just a room, it's a whole bloody... floor. It's a whole apartment. It is like many rooms, and the genius is that, yes, you go up these creaky wooden stairs and you smell it before you see it.
Yeah.
And there across the threshold, when you get to the top landing, is a piece of glass, so you can see that it's about a yard thick, and it is, as you say, moist. You know, it's regularly sterilized, because he doesn't want anything growing in it. He wants this potential of the earth.
Looking around the Royal Academy show and getting to that last room where you have the flooded gallery and the mud, I couldn't help but think of the Earth Room.
Yeah.
He's still clearly an influence, a big influence on you.
Yeah,
isn't he?
I think that the Earth Room, in a sense, particularly. The fact that it's sterilized and held, I would like to say this is my conversation with the Earth Room, saying, well, actually, this is a living experiment. We've brought seawater and clay from Buckinghamshire together. This is actually a live situation. There is the production of gas. There is organic matter in there, which will evolve. But Walter is there in that piece. My conversation with him is continuing, as it were, after his death. I think he intuitively was interested in the same questions about human future. What was our part going to be in the evolution of life on this planet? It's a question for every single one of us.
So you've talked about the work you made, Another Place, Crosby Beach, those figures, and you've talked about the work you wish you'd made, Lightning Field, Walter de Maria, and possibly many other Walter de Maria pieces that have provided a conversation for your work, which continues. We're in the studio. There are new pieces all around us on a table, these
black paintings with that look like irises. They look like close-up of an eye. They possibly are black holes in space. They may be exploding stars. But I guess this is only one of many projects which is on the go in your studio space here.
Yeah, there's always stuff bubbling up. But the piece that I'm so excited about, because it's such an honour and an extraordinary invitation. I was invited by Philippe de Bellaval, who is the Minister des Monuments Historiques in France, to come to Brittany to this extraordinary barrow grave that's called Barnenez. It's on the north coast of Brittany, and it's the largest passage tomb of the early farmers. So we know about the Boyne Valley and Newgrange and Howth and Nowth, these incredible Neolithic monuments in Ireland. Mm. But there is one with 10 passage graves and one huge tumulus that is on this raised hillside
in Brittany.
above the northern shore of Brittany, in a place called Barnenez. And he's invited me to make a response.
In situ, what, to sit alongside it, nearby?
Basically, to the north of Barnenez, there's a whole cluster of islands and peninsulas. And I'm going to make these works that will be about 4 metres high, probably weighing about 6 tonnes each, made out of cast iron. The first one will stand on the beach. They are brutal. They're made out of massive blocks.
Monoliths.
And they are really monoliths. But they're made of up to 30 blocks that are balanced one on top of the other, but now made solid. So they're single castings.
Cubes? Are they cuboid?
They're slabs.
Right.
So they're massive houses of cards, but made out of blocks that do actually cohere. So they're an attempt to say something about the human condition, that we're sort of provisional and that we kind of stand up, but we're in danger always of falling over. and yet we're always looking for what's happening in the future. So they'll have this, they are essentially stacks of slabs that could be stone but actually are iron. And they
standing.
Will go out. They will go. The first one is on the beach. Yeah. The second one is on a promontory that runs out from the beach. The third one is on an island that is about 300 meters away. And they will go out to about 3 kilometers out
into the sea.
Into the sea, but attached to rocks around these islands.
How many of them all in all?
There are 7 altogether.
God. That's quite a way out. That's a busy shipping lane.
I am on my way there. In 2 weeks' time, I will be going rather too late in the day with the marine engineers and the harbour authorities to inspect the sites and see what dangers there are for shipping.
So this is a project which is conceived, commissioned.
This is conceived. It may not happen. We may not get all the necessary authority permissions.
These are artworks which do have an eye to the future, which are about kind of resilience, I guess, but also having that dialogue with the ancient past, with the Neolithic past.
And you said they're in direct. I guess that I want them to be rooted in their relationship with the ancient past and the first farmers, with whom I have an enormous. Well, what is it? It's a combination of absolute admiration and a certain degree of envy. I mean, the Ring of Brogna, the Stones of Stenness, Stonehenge, the Rollright Stones, Avebury. I mean, they had no technology at all and yet had this collective imagination that they were going to mark the face of the planet with something that was going to last for thousands, for millennia. Well, that is two things. One is it is a profound expression of hope in the collective future of our species, but it's also this belief that somehow we have to work with what we are given, with an inherited earth, imaginatively, to make the richest possible future arise. And I still feel that you know, that's the work that sculpture can do. That's the work that sculpture can do, and that's the work that somehow I've been called to do. So, yes, this work has a profound relationship with that inspiration, that inspirational past, but I want it to be about the future, and I want it to be about asking questions about the future and the sustainability of our, in a way, relationship with the elemental world. We cannot continue to be exploiters of natural resources that we think of as being free, because they're not. This may never happen. It may, you know, it may just be a wish, but I'm very, very excited about it, because I think it combines all of the things that I love most. An attitude to the future rooted in the past.
And looking out in the same way that your figures on Crosby Beach are looking towards America, these are Brittany looking back towards Britain.
Yeah,
it re-establishes that link at a time when there is a political division on that horizon. Does Brexit come into play? Does it have any effect on what will happen, whether it will get made, on the meaning of the world,
maybe? I hope that it is a reinforcement of the fact that, you know, certainly, I mean, Brittany, Wales, Scotland and Ireland, these are Celtic homelands. You know, I'm partly Irish. I feel a huge love for, I think, those parts of the world where somehow the cry of seabirds, the smell of bladder wrack, the exposed granite of the bones of the world is visible. And I think, you know, Brexit is just a stupid kind of moment of collective fibrillation. We belong to Europe. We belong geologically to Europe. We were only separated 5,000 years ago. The whole idea that somehow we can go it alone with greater relationships with former Commonwealth or with friends and cousins in America, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
And on a practical level, I mean, if Britain does leave the EU, so politically, financially, and all of those institutional links between British, you know, museums and artists, I mean,
culturally, it's an absolute disaster. We know that very clearly. I mean, the immediate loss of billions of European-funded projects. I'm working in Plymouth at the moment, and the whole regeneration of that 250,000-strong, remarkable city that has suffered from a certain amount of social deprivation is funded by Europe, as are many areas that have been the ones that have voted to leave, none of which makes any sense to anybody. We need to refresh our own visions of ourselves by our conversations with our neighbours on every level: visual art, dance, music, theatre, poetry, academic research. On all of those fronts, the dialogues that we have with France and Germany and Italy, I mean, basically all of our European neighbours, these are really, really, really important moments. How do you understand yourself other than by your relationships with your nearest neighbours? Anyway, sorry, we mustn't get involved in Brexit because it's too depressing. And
we wandered off there. I've got to say, the tea's fantastic. Yeah, Chinese tea.
Yeah, no, Taiwanese.
Oh, Taiwanese, is it?
Taiwanese, so these are the first leaves from the oolong plant that are then dried and then rolled into these amazing little balls.
Tiny pellets. Look at that. Absolutely wonderful.
And so it's the size of a pea or a little smaller.
Beautiful.
Anyway,
and very tasty tea.
Tea is a lovely thing. Tea.
Anthony, I've got to let you get on with your work.
Okay.
It's been absolutely fabulous talking to you.
Lovely. It's lovely having you here.
And if you enjoyed this conversation with Anthony Gormley, I hope you'll enjoy hearing the artistic choices of some of my other guests in the series, including songwriters Paul Weller, Natalie Merchant, Guy Garvey, and Tom O'Dell. Playwrights Lucy Prebble and Kwame Kwayama. Actress Hayley Atwell talks about three roles. Richard Curtis chooses three films, and there are more on the way. Please do rate and review the series, and remember, we're on Twitter and Instagram.
These Three is presented and produced by me, John Wilson, in association with Analog Folk. Thanks very much for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.